Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline. In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by James, and we're going to be discussing Camelot 3000 from DC. It was published back in 1982, or at least that's when it started. James, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, John?
I am doing well. Now, I read this when it first came out. I'm pretty sure I read this off the rack, virtually positive of it, but I mean, 82, that was a few years ago. My memory's not what it used to be, but I read this off the rack, and I remember some delays later on and stuff. Had you read this before?
No, I remember seeing this comic there, and at the time, I had only been reading Marvel comics, and so I was like, oh, that's something weird. You know, it wasn't the first issue, it was something DC. I was like, it just wasn't a publisher that I was reading. I didn't read much of any DC at the time, so I just stuck to my Marvel stuff that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of regret that, because reading this, I did enjoy it.
Oh, yeah, it was a ton of fun back then. I really enjoyed it this time. I'll be honest, when we were talking about doing it for the book club, which I thought this was a great recommendation Brawlinator had and stuff. I mean, it's first off, it's Mike Barr on the writing. He's a great writer. It's Brian Bolan on art. He's top notch. And these two guys worked so well together on this. But I was thinking, okay, it's a 1980s comic. I haven't read it for 40-ish years. How wordy is this going to be? Is it going to be one that's fun but a little work to get through? It wasn't. It pulled me all the way through. It was such an easy read.
It was an easy read, and this was in kind of stark contrast to Daredevil that we had read in the book club,
mm-hmm.
which was very verbose, and it just kind of, I don't want to say it was a struggle. It wasn't bad material. It's just a lot more wordy. You almost couldn't see the art, whereas here the art was very easy to see, and like you said, the book almost flowed. I'd read through it. I was like, oh, that read pretty quick while being enjoyable.
I never felt the writing and the art was fighting with each other at all in this, whereas in Born Again, I kind of felt that way.
Yeah, there were certain panels in the book club we were looking at it, and you're like, I know that's a cool piece of art, but it's literally covered up by text boxes, so you couldn't enjoy it. And here we got pretty much the art is the hero, while the writing's solid too. The art is definitely on display and put forward. So Brian Bolan, I love him from Judge Dredd. I always go back to that.
Well, this is some of his early North American work, and by which I mean it was published in North America. He, of course, was living over in Britain at the time, which, if you're going to do an Arthurian thing, getting a British artist, not a bad move at all.
Definitely not.
But again, this was 1982. Working with somebody overseas today, not that hard. Yeah, there's the time zone issue, but you can coordinate that. You can hop on Zoom, you can chat, you can discuss stuff. 1982? You couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I can't remember that well because I was just a kid, but FedEx and UPS weren't the behemoths they are today with shipping. It was probably mailing stuff via the postal service in the UK and the postal service in the United States to get stuff back and forth. And I don't know if they called or wrote letters, but it must have been extremely difficult, but they worked it out, and they worked that out fantastically.
Based on the Wikipedia page for Camelot 3000, and I recommend reading it. It's not that long. It's got some interesting stuff about tidbits about the backstory. But this, I think, was written kind of full script style.
Okay.
That gave, basically, Mike Barr, I think, was smart enough to realize, hey, we're not going to have time for a back and forth. That just isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So if I want what I want, let's put it all on the page. If the artist needs to make changes, he can make changes, but let's give him everything he needs.
Makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Smart move. Smart move. And this is something Mike Barr, I think this was a passion project for him, because it sounds like he'd been trying to get it going for years, having had it turned down at DC, then Marvel was going to do it, but it didn't come through. DC decided to do it. So I think both Mike Barr put 110% into it. Certainly Brian Bolan did, because I think this was what really put him on the map in the North American market, and I think he knew that. And he was constantly trying to top himself, which on the one hand, I really respect an artist that does that. On the other hand, it was saying it took him about 9 months to draw that final issue.
Yeah.
There comes a part where perfection gets in the way of producing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And that's kind of disappointing when it slows down the book so much for the reader who was buying it monthly. That was the only option back then.
When the 12th issue came out in April of 1985, I was a regular at the local comic store. I forget if I was working there at the time or not. But I was there. Somebody had pulled the thing off the rack, went over to one of the other guys working at the shop at the time. It's like, how can this be the 12th issue and stuff? I've been shopping here for a year. I've never seen this before. What's going on? And he's like, yeah, it's late. Now, today, to say, yeah, it's late, it's like, well, what do you expect? It's a comic book. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
Back in 1982, it did not.
They kept things on time.
If you were late, you were late by a week, maybe two, and that was not that common. Now, instead, you would have fill-in issues, or TBA is the creative team for various issues of Thor for a fairly long period, actually, at one point, it seemed like. But the books shipped. And so for this thing to have had the delays it did was unusual. But I also recall this being very well received at the time. And I'm pretty sure this was one of the titles that every year when I got the new Overstreet price guide, I would check to see how it was doing.
Oh, okay.
Because it was popular. It was, again, hard to find. It went up in value. Now, again, let's put that in 1982 to 85 context. Books did not shoot up to the $100 mark like they do today overnight or whatever. This thing would get up to, I want to say, $35 at some point in it, and I forget exactly when that was.
Wow.
But it was one of those things that I would look at it from year to year in the thing. It would go up, it would go up, it would go up. But then you hit this point where the series is done. There's okay. Nothing to renew that interest.
Oh.
It would stabilize, it would stabilize, it would drop, it would drop, it would drop. Now, I'm according to the last Overstreet guide, or at least the one I have on the top of my stack, which I assume is the last one, these issues are all going for $5 a piece.
Wow, that's crazy. And adjusting for inflation, that $35 was worth a heck of a lot. You know, yeah. Probably like $150 today. I have no idea.
But the difference between this and something else that had that same sort of value back then as an issue, say, of Batman, like Batman Year One or something like that, or I'm trying to think what would be another good example. But normally those would be ongoing titles.
Exactly. So you always have that readership there, whereas this was one of the first maxi series.
I think for DC, I think it was the first.
Yeah. And so with that happening, yeah, the readership kind of left the book and people weren't clamoring who didn't know about it.
12 issues, it's done. Maybe you see the trade. But after that, it's only word of mouth. And now 40 years later, I think this is very much a hidden gem of the comic industry.
I would agree with you there. I mean, this is something you slot into those good nostalgic comics. There's comics that we've had nostalgia for and we've done book clubs on and we're like, oh man, I remember this being better. It just doesn't read well today. And this was really enjoyable. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a little bit ahead of its time with the maxi series things. This is kind of like a common thing now. And very innovative with what they're doing. The art was great. The story was familiar, even though it was completely foreign, because it's dealing with the King Arthur mythos that we all know a little something about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start branching off from the main characters. Okay, I know Lancelot. I know this guy, that guy. Okay, now, who is that knight? I don't remember him.
Well, and the origin of this is Mike Barr had taken a course on the Arthurian legend and stuff, really enjoyed it and thought, wow, wouldn't that be a cool thing to do as a comic? When he finally got it going at DC, he brought on the guy who taught that particular class he took as a creative consultant, just to, I think, make sure he got all the Arthurian stuff right.
Ah, very clever. Very clever.
Smart move, and what a trip that had to be for the professor.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, here's this kid, and now he's suddenly bringing this to the, I won't say to the masses, but you know what I mean. Bringing it to a new audience that may, in some cases, have been discovering the Arthurian legends and stuff for the first time.
And he's getting to see the art that goes along with it. He's getting to see basically just a different take with the whole alien invasion, and it's taking place in the future, but
mm-hmm.
nodding to all the characters in the past. It was really cool. It was something different, something I didn't expect.
This could have easily fallen into the neither fish nor fowl thing of it's neither really a good Arthurian tale, nor is it really a good sci-fi tale, but it was really good on both sides of that.
Yeah, I would agree. I enjoyed it as both a sci-fi and as an Arthurian tale.
Mm-hmm. I think if you were to take either side of that out, it's obviously not the same story. At that point, it's just Camelot or it's just 3,000. But they mixed the two really well, and it was a ton of fun.
Yeah, And I'll tell you what, Mike Barr was way ahead of the game because he did some things that it seems like it was set up as a joke, you know? I don't want to say a joke, but something that you had to deal with there, where one of the characters came back as Japanese. One of the characters, the knights, where they were... Mm-hmm.
They've been reincarnated, but not as they were.
Yeah, one Japanese, one was African character. And then another one came back as a woman who was literally getting married at the altar to get married to this other man, and then realized, I'm a knight, I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, which today takes on a whole new context. But back in the 80s, you know, this is something people are like, wow, you know, that's kind of surprising. I wouldn't expect that. This is different.
The fact that DC published this back in the 80s.
It's insane.
It says something good about DC.
Yeah.
But according to the Wikipedia page, they got some letters from some people saying kind of, what the hell?
Yeah, because
again,
they didn't like it.
It was playing with ideas that were not commonplace back then.
And you really can see that this is so ahead of its time, not necessarily because of the alien invasion, but because of the changing of races and the changing of sexes with characters. And that was, I would imagine, groundbreaking for that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it well. I mean, I didn't find the book offensive at all.
No, I didn't either now or back then. But it was certainly food for thought in some cases. One of the story elements that I thought they handled really well was the whole betrayal of Lancelot and Guinevere.
Yes. How did you like that?
Well, it was kind of weird in so much as Arthur knew it had happened.
Yes.
These are new people. They are Lancelot and Guinevere, and they're not Lancelot and Guinevere.
Yes.
And then when Merlin flat out tells Arthur, there can be no betrayal because you're not wed yet. You haven't married this Guinevere. So put things in the right order, buddy. And that was kind of interesting, because then, you know, Arthur announces the wedding. He, of course, hadn't consulted Guinevere on any of this. But to see some of that play back out when Tom, who's kind of the audience stand-in, if you will, in the story, pulls aside Lancelot, it's like, why are you doing this, buddy? You betrayed him before, do you need to do it again? That whole exchange played well, it was well done, and then when the betrayal happened, it made sense how it plays out. It didn't feel like we're going around the exact same circle the exact same way, but there are certain things that people are who they are.
Yeah, they are who they are, and I found myself really disliking Guinevere. I mean, I never liked her to begin with because, like, married to the King Arthur and with the guy's best friend, you know, has an affair. And they see it coming. And so literally, I didn't know if I disliked Arthur, what he chose to do, or Guinevere in this story. Because if you know she's likes this guy, she's betting, you know, Lancelot, I wouldn't rush to marry her. That's just me. I'd be like, I'm going to find a different lady this time.
I think that could have been a very interesting twist on the story here if Arthur had realized they do love each other and he is tight with both of them and wants them to be happy, if he had just stood back and let them be together.
Exactly, because that's where I'm thinking, okay, I see this. I like, this is my best friend. She obviously likes him more than me. We are not married. Do your thing. And he could have found someone else. I mean, he's King Arthur.
I would have had him not find someone else.
Yeah, maybe. Be a loner.
A loner. He would not have the counsel of Guinevere as he had in the past. There would have been a cost to that. The question is, would that have been as high of a cost as the betrayal or not?
Exactly. Instead of going through the exact same motions again. I mean, now that story about King Arthur and Lancelot, that is a classic story. You've seen movies where it happens, whether it be A Knight's Tale, or you've read about it. We all know the story. I can see your gut being ripped out if you really love that person and that whole thing with your best friend. I don't think I would have him be around me. I'd be like, you're not in my court anymore. I can't sit here and watch this. I can't be friends with you. I move on, but that's me, you know.
Flip side, you're facing down an alien invasion, and this is the best knight you've got.
Exactly, and that's why I say, maybe he's a better man than me. Maybe I'm petty, but yeah. He literally, that's his best fighter. That's the person he needs the most, and a person that he trusts is on the battlefield. Maybe he doesn't trust with his woman, but trust him on the battlefield.
Well, and again, it could have been interesting if Arthur had stood aside, let Lancelot and Guinevere get married, and then Gwen basically goes for Arthur.
Yeah.
You could have played her as, I don't want to say the villain in the piece, but kind of. I mean, there's half a dozen different ways you could have gone there. But what they did worked. It was fun. Now, I am no expert in the Arthurian stuff. I mean, I've read some of the stuff. I've watched some of the movies. Saw Camelot, the musical and stuff, a number of times on video and stuff like that. Great music. So I've got a familiarity with the Arthurian legend. Could I tell you who all of the various knights were and stuff? No. Did I remember who the hell Kay was? Absolutely not. But this rings true to everything that I think is kind of iconic about the Arthurian stuff in modern pop culture.
Yeah.
And did a really good job with that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the movie that pops to mind the most when I think of King Arthur's First Knight came out in the 90s. And I just remember that one. I really liked it. But I'll tell you what, it worked for me. It felt familiar, familiar enough. And I think any reader who has grown up in the Western Hemisphere will say, or has grown up in Europe, will be familiar. They'll have that familiar feeling because they know these tales. And then on top of that, you have a great comic story and it just works. I also really enjoyed the Sir Tristan, Lady Tristan thing, reincarnated as into a woman's body. Did that work for you? Because at times it was kind of like a joke and it was funny because they kept revisiting it. And at other times it was very serious and heartfelt. And I felt like Mike Barr was living, his mind was in 2025 now versus 19.
Yeah, he was definitely ahead of his time versus 1980s.
Because I'm thinking back in the 1980s, I'd have been like, that's weird. I was a kid, you know, I was 9 years old, 10 years old. This doesn't make any sense. This is weird. But he was way ahead of the time as far as writing this and dealing with real issues that we see today.
I think that aspect of the story would play out differently today with a modern writer.
Yeah.
And I could see a number of different ways, like it wouldn't phase Tristan at all, or it would phase Tristan even more, or whatever. So there's again, 100 directions they could go in there. But I like that they played it light at times, serious at times. It totally made sense that Morgan Le Fay was going to use that as a, I will turn you back how you expect to be if you will betray the knights.
Exactly. Tristan was willing to do anything because being trapped and being unhappy. And so you can see that, yeah, Morgan Le Fay comes into play. And the ribbing, I think, would not happen so much in a modern day comic, but at times it was kind of funny because the pure rage from Tristan and the other characters, I think that's something that you couldn't do today.
Well, I liked how Tristan and Percival kind of got along because of a very different yet somewhat shared experience of they're not who they used to be.
Exactly, yes.
Because Percival turns into a neo-man, which is they take people that have been incarcerated, genetically modify them into almost, you know, quasi-Hulk beings as enforcers and stuff for the government. And they could barely think or whatever. And I thought the way Percival was used in this story was really interesting.
I love Percival. Percival was that Hulk-like character, but almost like he couldn't communicate, but he had intelligence to where he was a leader of the Neo-Men, who were, before Percival was there, they just kind of were subservient slaves. They didn't follow any leader, really.
Well, and this is where being kind of awoken by the magical pendant to get his past memories and stuff as he's being turned into the Neo-Man and stuff arguably kind of counteracted the dumbification of the process.
Exactly. I didn't like that.
So he was literally trapped in this hulking body, but was able to make use of it too.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
I love how at one point they're pinned down with the aliens, fighter ships kind of strafing at him, and Arthur's like, you know what you need to do, Percival? Percival picks up this huge boulder and just chucks it at one of these ships, destroying it. I mean, total Hulk moment or whatever, but it was fun. It was classic. It was, again, they had the nods to the superheroic in places, although it's certainly not a superhero story. But it's a comic book thing in the 80s, so people are going to be familiar with that if they're reading the book.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not going to say the sci-fi aspect was groundbreaking or anything of the sort, but it hit all the notes you expected an alien invasion kind of a story to hit and whatnot. Did it well. We got to kind of know and understand this alien culture to a degree, as much as we needed to.
Yeah.
They fit the role of the bad guy foot soldiers to a T.
Yeah, I would agree. I thought that was done excellently. And there were so many things in here that were done very well. I really liked, I asked a question in the book club on the Slack channel. they started putting some like religious iconography. You know, you'd have the Holy Grail was a big part of this, you know?
Yeah.
And religious. And the characters kept saying, you know, by J-E-S-U, by Jesu.
Jesu or whatever, yeah.
Jesu, yeah. I was like, is this supposed to be Jesus? Or like, were they offended to write the name in the comic? I'm just like, who's this Jesu or Jesu that they're saying? And luckily, Brawlinator's like, hey, you know, an old text back in Arthur's day, whenever these tales came about, that was a shortened way of writing Jesus. I was like, oh, well, that makes sense, because I was trying to figure out, is this like some kind of different deity? They didn't want to offend people who weren't Christian. I just didn't understand why they were doing that.
I figured it was of the time. I'm willing to bet Lamort de Arthur, that's how it is.
Yeah. So that was kind of cool. That was the cool thing about the book club, is you pick up a few hints. So you're like, oh, that's kind of cool. I didn't know that. And then, like I said, the religious iconography, the Holy Grail thing really worked for me, because they took the Grail to a whole new level, more so than I think even Raiders of the Lost Ark did. Or what was it, the Indiana Jones one? It wasn't the Raiders of the Lost Ark where they did the Grail, but whichever one that was.
Oh, that was the third one.
The third one, exactly. I don't remember the name of it. But where they went after the chalice, the cup of Christ, and here they incorporated it into the armor of a character who was the bad guy.
Well, and it can heal, so you slice him up, he heals. You know, it's hard to defeat somebody that way.
That was a clever use of the Holy Grail, something that we've never seen, and I was like, it works, and it was fun.
What was your thoughts of the way they used Excalibur?
I liked it. I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, it was different, but it worked. How about you?
It was interesting. There were a couple of places that, I mean, it totally worked, but I would not have expected him to be able to power a starship with the sword.
That's true.
At the end, he seems to, like, slice an atom and cause a nuclear explosion with the sword. So, I mean, this thing, if it can be done, Excalibur can do it. But you've also got one of the most known mythological weapons of all time right here, too.
Exactly. And back then, they didn't know how powerful it was. And now we just happen to see how powerful it is. And I just love that Mike Barr, that he took things that we know and he modified them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And modified it in a fun way, I would say.
Well, and in a way that stays true to the core conceit.
Yes.
Excalibur is not just a weapon, it is the weapon.
Yes, the ultimate weapon.
Yeah. So can it do this? The answer's almost always going to default to, well, yeah, sure, why not? You know, and he did it in a way where it didn't seem like, okay, they're all going to die unless he can magically do this, and sure enough, he can. That would have felt like a cop-out, but the way they used it, how they used it, when they used it, played into the story. It didn't kind of, quote-unquote, solve the story.
Yeah.
So it worked for me, but it was definitely a much more versatile sword than I would have expected.
I agree. It was way more versatile, and Arthur was using it to take down spaceships of the aliens at one point, which was just awesome.
Well, there are a couple where he's going to slice things in half. I mean, this thing can cut through literally anything like butter.
Yeah, it's a lightsaber on steroids.
Yeah. What got me, though, was when he had the betrayer in the midst, I think it was around issue 8 or whatever, and he's like, an Excalibur can tell who's lying. And it's like, yeah, I can't, but they didn't know that, so it worked.
It worked.
And if they had gone with the route of it could, I'd have bought it.
It's true. This book is summed up, honestly, in just one word. It's fun. It's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Pick one of those. Fun or enjoyable, this is it. Like I told you, when I was reading it for the first time, you're like, did you like it? I was like, it's not like I'm going to say it's the best comic I ever read. But yeah, I enjoyed the heck out of it. I had a good time reading it. I'm happy I read it. It was something that it reminds me why I like these comics from the 80s, you know, 70s and 80s, because they were just, I don't want to say more enjoyable, but at times they do feel more enjoyable than a lot of what we get today.
Mm-hmm.
Just a ton of fun. I just loved it from the moment when Arthur was coming up out of his little grave, picking up a metal rod that he used as a sword to beat the heck out of people, and picks up a gun and figures out how to shoot. Instantly. It was just a ton of fun.
Yeah, he's quick on the uptake. He has to get the sword back out of the stone again, so we see some of the classic iconography playing out in new ways. And yeah, I think this was a good story. Was it a tight, bulletproof, perfect story? No.
No.
But it was highly enjoyable, and I really think DC has missed the boat to not have turned this into an animated feature or live action or something.
Yeah.
Because this is, again, one of those hidden gems at DC that was really well known when it came out, but over the decades, people have forgotten about it because there was nothing to remind them. But I don't want to see a Camelot either 3001 or Camelot 4000 or something like that. If it had the right creative team, I might go for it, but I'll be honest, I'd go in with skepticism because this is a tough act to follow.
It's a tough act to follow, and it's a story that's told and doesn't need to be revisited, really. I feel like it was a story that was told, and it's done.
Yeah.
Like a typical Image story. You know, when they get to issue whatever it is, 12 or 60, there's typically nothing more to be that needs to be told. It's been wrapped up. And that's how this story was.
Yeah, this ended with some finality. Are there a few threads you could tug on and go with later? Like what happens to Tom after the story, or what do these characters do, or whatever? Sure. But nothing that has to be told, nothing that mandates being told, and nothing that would really, I think, suffice as a satisfying sequel.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I would agree wholeheartedly, actually, with everything you said. It's wrapped up. This is done in one. And I remember when we first started reading this, one of my first questions before I actually cracked the book, I was like, hey, is this something where DC's expounding on it? They don't want to lose the IP? Are they, what world is this on? Basically assuming this is world 32 or something, but it really is separate from the DCU. It's almost an indie comic that DC published.
Yeah, absolutely. It is mentioned in Who's Who. It gets an entry there. It has never been dubbed Earth whatever. And I don't know if there's ever been anything that would tie this into any version of the canonical DC universe, multiverse, or what have you. And I think that's a good thing, because it doesn't need any of that. I think it would be lessened by some of that.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't want to see a Before Camelot 3000 a la Before Watchmen or something of that sort either.
Yeah, I would agree. This is, for me, perfect the way that they packaged it. And me personally, although you say, hey, this is great, I need to see more, I feel like I don't need to see anything more from here. And I would say that about several comics. You know, Why the Last Man? It's a book I love. I don't feel like I need to reread anything coming out of that world. It was done, and I'm happy with where it was.
I want to see more like this, not more of this.
That's a perfect way to say it. Yeah. More things of this ilk. More things that are just fun and enjoyable, and they don't take themselves too seriously, and yet an easy read. I don't like to be talked down to. I don't like something to be inaccessible. I like something to be accessible, flow, written tightly and enjoyable. You do that and you're going to have me as a customer for life. I'm going to keep reading your stuff.
Yeah. And this was tightly written. There were not things that were just there for the sake of being there and didn't go anywhere, but it was not so tightly written it had a stranglehold over things either.
Correct.
You miss any little thing and you're lost or something. It was a nice, easy, breezy read in all of the right ways. Good action, good adventure type story. So the fact that they've kept the trade, I think, in print the entire time. I don't think there's anything more they need to do with this, but this is the sort of thing where I know at least once they did a reprint of the first issue just to kind of whet people's appetite again. Why they don't do that once in a while as a free comic book day issue or something like that, I don't know.
I do suspect that people from Marvel and DC are fans of the podcast and listen to you, because we have said things here and it's come to fruition, which is kind of crazy. And who knows? Maybe someone will hear this Camelot 3000 enjoyment that we're having and maybe revisit the property to, hey, maybe this is something we can look at animating. Hey, maybe this is something we should repackage in a hardcover or something. You know, just get some sales out of it. Stoke some interest in here. And
yeah,
I think an animated series would be fantastic. Something very easy to do.
I think that'd be easier to do than, I think casting this as a live action movie, it could be done. I don't know who I'd put in the various roles.
Yeah.
But you would need a good cast for this to live up to the material.
Yeah, I would agree. It would come down to the casting and the budget, because yeah, there would have to be special effects here. So I think animated would be much easier.
Yeah, but even today, a TV budget could do it.
Yeah, that's true. There's nothing in here that's insanely over the top.
I mean, the only thing that would have prevented them doing it, even as a, I don't say on a TV budget back in the 80s, but I mean, blasters, ships, that sort of thing you could do. The aliens would have been the hard part.
Yeah.
The Neo-Men would have been a little challenging, but even that they could have done.
And that's really easy to do today with our technology, CGI or whatever.
Yeah, today they could do just a ton of stuff. Like, New Camelot would be awesome to look at and stuff like that. But I definitely think this is the sort of property that they should be getting out there as, hey, DC is more than just superheroes. And I think doing the first issue as a free comic book day thing coinciding with, hey, and we're going to get the trade back out there or something. Keep it low cost, keep it accessible, get people interested in the property. I mean, there's a ton of things in their back catalog like this that are just languishing because nobody's giving it a promotional push.
Yeah, and stuff like that, like I said, I think that could work. Like a free comic book day with a hardcover and then maybe a softcover shortly after that would generate some easy cash. And here we are, we started this long-form Warlord spotlight, and then lo and behold, we're getting a Warlord omnibus. Like I said, someone at DC is listening, I swear.
Well, I know people at DC have listened to the podcast, certainly read the articles I did over on comic book resources and stuff. Sometimes I think they liked what they heard and read. Sometimes I don't know, but...
Not so much. Yeah, and also at Marvel, you know, I mean, like, there's things that we've spoken about and it's happened. And I'm not saying we're making a decision, but I think if we're getting enjoyment and we're just two voices and we are completely different people, you and I.
Yeah.
I mean, you're the DC guy. You grew up DC. I'm the Marvel zombie who did not read DC. And when we find those things that you and I can both enjoy, you know, bazinga, as they used to say on the Big Bang Theory, that's something you need to run with, you know, because, hey, I'm going to get customers from both sides, from people who may not be longtime fans and people who may be a first time reader. This is that.
Well, and this is the sort of book that I think creators, if they haven't read it or haven't read it in a while, ought to check out.
Yeah.
Because I can see a number of artists these days that are kind of on that verge of becoming that really A-list artist or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron LaPresti is the one that's coming to mind for me right now. If he were to do something of this ilk, again, not a Camelot space, you know, kind of a thing, but look at this, figure out what works, what is his passion project, like this was Mike Barr's, what could he do really cool art with and something like that? What has that action adventure easy read that pulls you from issue to issue, do that kind of a story? That we need more stories like this out there is what it comes down to.
Yeah. If we had more stories like this, I think you'd have happy readers. And not only that, this lends itself to an all ages audience.
Yes.
You could be a 10-year-old and I think you'd like this story. And here I am, a 51-year-old, and I really like this story. And I don't feel like I'm being talked down to. I don't feel like it's a kid's book. Yet I don't feel like it's excluding kids either. And that those are hard to do. I don't even say they're hard to do. It's a lost art. It's something that Mike Barr did. And so few writers do that today.
Yeah. Again, this worked for me when I was a young teenager at the time, and I'm way past that now, and it worked just as well for me today.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I'm happy we did this at the book club. And that being said, at the time we're recording this, and this is January 2nd, we're recording 2025, we've only had one book club on this. We only did the first four issues, and you and I would have read all 12 for this podcast. But we're going to have two more book clubs on this, so it's kind of cool. I'm looking forward to more of this, our enjoyment for beyond this podcast with the group of guys that we got together at the book club. We have a ton of fun doing this.
Absolutely. And I'm planning on releasing this on January 13th. Hopefully it goes up then if no problems happen. The next book club we're going to do on it is that Thursday the 16th. If you would like to join, we're going to cover issues 5 through 8 there. We haven't scheduled the following one that'll do issues 9 through 12. Let me know. Let's get you on the forum and the Slack channel. If you want to go on the Slack channel or on the forum, not only do you have to go through the main webpage and fill out the thing, you must email me and let me know that you have done that with this username. And I can make sure you get approved and stuff like that. I have, over the last week or so, literally gotten over 100 plus bots trying to get into the forum and stuff.
That's crazy.
So I'm not checking each one of them. And then pretty obvious sometimes. It's like, okay, that was the first six characters and they're just rotating out the last three or something stupid like that. But that's why I need the human interaction of, hey, I'm a listener, I want to get on the book club, or I like the podcast, or whatever. Something to tell me you're not a bot, and that you want to get on the forum, you want to get in the Slack channel, and we'll get you into the book club and stuff like that on Zoom if you want to. Because again, we love talking about comics. I think this is a comic a lot of people would really enjoy.
I agree. Yeah, so hopefully we get some more people joining the book club, and it's always good when we get together. We have a ton of fun, and I'm very thankful for it because beyond you and I recording, it's kind of cool when we get together and it's just fans of the podcast. And it's almost like meeting at the comic book shop back in the day.
Exactly.
Talking about these books that you like and just having fun. And you put a face with a name because we use Zoom so we can see each other when we're talking. And we put up a big screen of the comic. We go through it. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's, again, like going to the comic store and talking about comics there, except you don't even need to leave home to do it.
Exactly. It's the ultimate introvert way to be an extrovert.
Exactly. Exactly. So hopefully we'll get some people joining and stuff. And again, if you can't make it on the 16th, we're going to have another book club a couple of weeks later. I don't know if it'll be the 30th or if it'll be February 6th or exactly when it'll be. But we've got a book club channel on Slack, and that's where we kind of coordinate all of that.
Yeah. And it's literally a good group of guys. We don't talk about nonsense. We just talk about comics. We have fun. And literally for the first 30 minutes, we just hang out, shoot the breeze, and have fun.
Yeah, it's a social hour as much as anything else, but we talk about the comics. And I love seeing and hearing what other people got out of the story versus what I did and things of that sort. Again, ton of fun.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything else?
No, that does it for me.
Cool. Recording clips for the Preview Spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the Preview Spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The deadline is typically the second Saturday of the month at 9 a.m. Check the main page of the website for more information and the exact deadline for the next Preview Spotlight. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, please spread the word about the Comic Book Page podcast by telling your friends and posting a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please join our Slack community and let us know what you thought of this episode. I do this podcast because I enjoy talking about comics. So let's talk about comics. The show notes, forum, and instructions for how to join our Slack channel can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. The opinions of the co-hosts and guests are their own. The Comic Book Page podcast is copyright John Mayo. And thanks again for listening.